waves of particles made, organized by chance and fate. Did something for you, 'cause it's you, baby, 'cause it's you. You turn me on, you turn me on, you turn me on. You turn me on, you turn me on. These radio waves you hear are free as the atmosphere and love. And what are guest is Mark Davella, who in the late 20th century, as we can call it now, was part of a small group of university professionals who formed a radical organization modeled after the iconic radical organizations of the 60s and 70s, and it was called Davis Haight. Mark, welcome to the program, and it's a pleasure to have you, especially as this signifies your first month, as it were, officially out of hiding. And so congratulations on that.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, I guess, first of all, before we get into Davis Haight and its unusual name and its vague mission, where have you been since 1998?
I have actually been in hiding here in my hometown, the same town I was in these last 20 years.
And did you find that anyone was looking for you? Did it require...
No.
So it was simply your wanted status was a matter of... on paper.
It was something I lived with. I was aware of it at all times. But yes, it was a bureaucratic situation more than it was something I needed to change locations. Or
did you modify your lifestyle in any way?
I lived lease to lease instead of owning a home.
Lease to lease.
Yes.
But that's normal.
I guess in a town like this, it's
sure.
fairly average.
Right.
And I aspired to be as average as possible and just fit in.
Yeah.
And
you worked and
I held jobs.
Several jobs.
In a couple of different stores and wrote for the local newspaper.
Did you use credit cards and have other...
I did. I did. Yeah, I was not off the grid. I was so on the grid that no one really seemed to notice.
Or care.
So
you didn't really modify, or at least the full extent of the lifestyle modification was that you, for some reason, didn't feel comfortable buying a home?
I knew that I was in hiding, and it somehow seemed inappropriate for me to do something as lavish as own property.
So, were you fearful or concerned at all during these years of being discovered, or perhaps to say this wanted on paper status, this bureaucratic status of wantedness, suddenly crossing over to the realm of action? Was there a fear in
every
your heart?
So often at the post office, I would think that I was being recognized, but then I realized that it was only because the person behind the counter was actually my mail person.
Right. So
they knew me. They personally knew my name.
Right.
Not because
they never said anything implying that they knew that there might have been a bounty for your.
No.
Okay.
No. So it was all very on the back of my mind, but increasingly. Less on.
Well, let me come at it from the other angle then. As we know, there's a term between when you are an active radical and subversive, and when you're considered an enemy of the state in some way. And again, I don't use that word in melodramatically, romantically, but in some way you've been designated an enemy of the state. There's a term, and that is the term of exile, the term of hiding. Mm-hmm. And then after that, there can be, for many people, a period of being celebrated, a period of outlaw mythos and another a kind of romantic, and especially when once you are, as you are now, completely in the clear legally.
Yes.
Have you found that while you never had to actually endure any of the real sacrifices of exile, are you finding now that you get to enjoy some of the...
Yes, for instance, this interview right now
sure.
is an example of that. I did not have to go into a protection program or change my name or internal exile or external, foreign exile or.
Well, did anything?
I know Abby Hoffman lived 7 years,
abroad, and Osho had to leave the country.
Yes.
Have you kept in touch with any of your comrades or fellows from Davis Haight?
Yes, I see them online on social media. We have a group. We changed from being a private group to public.
So you stay in touch with them, and their experiences have been similar or markedly different from yours in their term of exile.
A couple of them were more vociferous in their complaints, and they suffered repercussions, which is part of why I kept my situation quiet.
What kind of repercussions?
I think one of them had to move to one town over.
Had to move one town over?
Yeah.
But there was no other plausible explanation for why they might have done that.
They may have just had a better deal.
Yeah. Because maybe they were in a high-tax town, and simply by moving two or three miles to the north, suddenly you find yourself in a town where the taxes are half or less, Sure. Common story.
That is so weird. You're going to have to stop. Because I can't hear you. I can't hear you. Just stop talking. I can't hear you. No, stop talking. I can't hear you.
Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out and relax.
The 90s, I'm not going to diss the 90s or dismiss the radicalism of the 90s, because it was the time when opposition to world trade agreements and things like that and a really litigatory kind of approach to protest, more so than the idealists and militant subversives of the 60s. There was a certain savvy to the protest culture of the 90s that it wasn't as widespread as its counterpart in the 60s, and it certainly can't claim the same legacy of cultural victories that the 60s radicals claim, whether accurately or not, depends on who you ask, of course. You know, we'll always have people who are deniers of the narrative of the 60s counterculture ending any wars or producing lasting social change. What would you say is the looking back, the achievement, lasting or otherwise, of Davis Haight?
Perhaps we provided a linkage between that era that you spoke of, the 60s radicals, and the radical movements, the anti-globalization movements of the early aughts that seem to have been better at getting media attention, if nothing else. I remember participating in a march in the 90s on the UN with many famous names and faces leading us and participating and speaking and rallying us, and we were down, you know, Fifth Avenue. And when I got home that night, the same home I still live in, there was no coverage in either local New York City media or the national media. It was fascinating. It was just a pebble thrown into the ocean of protest that didn't even
register on the national.
It was fascinating to see our invisibility.
Yeah. And so the legacy of Davis Haight would be that it barely even happened. It didn't move the needle of culture at all.
It didn't.
It did not.
And but we were a part of it.
And
the pride that we feel in that is...
And then at some point
you got
listed. We won't call it a blacklist, more of a brown list, more of a gray list. You were gray listed for your activities and participating in, was it specifically in organizations against world trade agreements, globalization?
Yes, and I wound up leaving the campus here
under
in the town.
Pressure?
Yes.
What kind of pressure was brought to bear? Proactive pressure by the administration to not house?
I was not given classes the next semester, and so I discovered that I did not have a paying job here.
Had you ever had a paying job here?
When I was a graduate student, they had me on a stipend.
On a stipend?
Yes, an award.
Right. But no one ever implied or told you directly that your association with Davis Haight had any reason, anything to do with why you weren't offered classes at the college?
No, I think my student reviews were poor that semester.
Is that because you were devoting all your time and energy to
Davis
Haight?
I was distracted
at best.
But my students didn't know about the protest.
Oh, really? So you weren't inculcating or attempting to turn them, convert them into radicals of a certain stripe.
No,
would you say, reflecting on the radicalism of the 90s and early aughts, would you say that it... Now we appear to be entering an age of the so-called professional activist. I'm sure you're familiar with that kind of concept, and that you can major in NGOs at the university level, and we're dealing with a professional class of activists. Would you say that there is any joy left in it, any sense of outlaw rebellion, any sense
of the grid,
or even any of the hedonism?
No one is off the grid because many of the activists and the hacktivists functioning right now in our culture are registered as such. They have it as their biographical blurb on various social media. They have their PGP key on there as a part of their biographical blurb. No one is really underground.
So there's no subterfuge left to the endeavor, and there's no. Now that everything is out in the open and all of the elephants are in the room, that you can't have the kind of a viable underground identity anymore. There's no underground.
If it's all above ground, maybe that's for the good. It's certainly no longer an underground.
Well, now, perhaps you were part of a purely theoretical, purely litigatory and sort of gestural roundup of radicals of the 90s, where a couple of laws were changed to allow people to put your name on a list. Mm. A couple of laws were changed to allow presidents to deem undesirables or subversives in some way. And nothing was ever done. There's just laws on the books that can be invoked if they ever need them. Does that seem about right?
That has been the history of the last almost 20 years. Yes.
So how was your particular situation resolved?
It expired.
Children in there for the haircuts he's the only show sort of in town and they won't let me cut their hair anymore, and the mother, she doesn't want to touch them because she's got this thing since the babies were born. They're repulsive. She keeps expressing that they were inside her and they're out. They were inside me and they're out. And she said, and I need to express that. I have to express that they were inside me and they're out. I just have to express that. And sometimes I can listen to it and I can empathize and I can want to say, well, you know, I suppose if I had to experience something that's absolutely overall, like, just consuming as gestating and trying to develop some form of relationship with an unknown thing, that it could be a dom. But then the thing comes out, and you look at it, and one of you is like, I was in love. I thought, Jesus, this kid looking is just amazing, you know, the whole time. It's kept saying, I can't. And she would just go, I got to express that. It just came out of me. I need you to understand. I have to express that. And I would say, I understand, but look, and she wouldn't look. And then, you know, everything got better for a while. And she made it nice. She put the clothes that people bought for the kid on the kid. And we'd all go out. We'd take pictures. We'd go places and things. And then we fell in love that way again. And, you know, and we had the next kid coming. And everything was sort of good in the build-up, but I could see her start to work into her eyes. I could see her start to get that, like, it's coming. It's coming, it's inside, and then it's going to come out. It's inside, and then it's going to come out. And our friend Dave came over, and Dave, he could relate, and the two of them bonded in a way that I was powerfully uncomfortable with. And they both had this, like, but then it's going to come out. And then when it did, it was the same thing all over again. And it's the same thing. And so there's sort of my responsibility, and I love him. She loves him, too, but I can't keep taking him to this guy, you know, and keep going, and they have to be cut like this. They have to be, because this one's like this, and that one's like that. And the guy just looks at me and goes, Dad, they're all the same from Adam to Zachary.
Have you noticed any changes in their behavior?
The kids?
Yeah.
No! They're still the same ones they were when they come out. You know, they're adorable and lovable, and they have... everybody's got a thing. Everybody's got at least one thing that you want to just, you'd want to grab them by the little hairs in their lower lip. If they had them, you'd encourage them to grow them. If they didn't, you'd grab them by those hairs and just pull down and go, you stop that. But, you know, but we all got that. That's why I don't grow hair on my lower lip anymore.
Hello, I am a robot. I have been programmed to inform that you are listening to WFMP, the cutting edge of the Hudson Valley. Thank you for listening. Robots will rule the Earth in 10 to 15 years.
88.7 FM. Here's your drop! the edge.
Are you facing foreclosure? Then come down to Megalo and Partners. We're a mortgage rescue company, and we can help you keep your house. Provided you submit to our plans for galactic domination. No, no, I'm kidding.
If you're facing foreclosure, talk to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
Are ye plagued by foreclosure? Well, here at Jim, Lad, and Matey, we can stop your foreclosure now. We're a mortgage rescue company, and for the small fee of everything you hold dear, we will negotiate with your lender on your behalf. Call Jim, Lad, and Matey at 1-800-YAR-YAR. That's 1-800-YAR-YAR-YAR.
If you're facing foreclosure, talk to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
So you're a writer? Well, that's wonderful.
David, this is not a joking matter. My pee is terribly divided, like a rope coming unbraided.
A playwright, you say? You know, I'm quite well connected here and in New York.
David! When you're finished with the coupons, it's time for my fruit colonic! Oh!
Oh, I'm sure you hear this from all the wealthy old gentlemen, but I would love to read your work.
David! I've had a terrible nightmare! Come hold me!
This is quite wonderful. I dare say it bears the mark of genius.
David! Writing plays may be your occupation, but I'm to be your preoccupation, do you understand?
Oh, the world conspires against such talents as ours, yours.
David, you're bruising me. I can't get it off. Please call for help. No, no, no one must see me like this.
Alas, my talent is not making art, but recognizing it. This the world has rewarded richly.
David, you've missed 3 rebates this month. This is unacceptable.
Come stay with me, then. You should write your plays and help me manage the estate when you can.
David, I'm not feeling well. And you're doing nothing to help me.
We shall share a life of art.
You might ask how I have become this person that I've become with really a rather late flurry of activity in my life. It seemed to me that my life was set in certain ways. Well, I wouldn't call them, I wouldn't call myself a failure any more than I would call any of you failures.
I kind of have to, I've accepted it. I don't mind being a failure.
Well, then I would say your failure is no such thing because you have turned failure into your art. Failure is your métier.
I'm very successful at failing.
Yes, I would say that based on your distinguished rank here in a room of people of which it could be said they are mostly of the failure.
Well, I inherited a great deal of money and real estate. With that, a lot of, just like, you know, the connections that were made before me. And they were sort of there when I got here. And I'm very, you know.
And so you've used this inheritance, this opulence that came to you through no credit of your own, but just being in the genetic line. You've used this to fail at a level that might be thought of as historic, kind of almost a, if not a perfection, a landmark in the history of failing as a artistic pursuit.
Well, I've been working very closely with a failure coach, who I brought with me today to explain a little bit about, you know, the program and my whole approach or lack thereof to responsible failure.
Dr. James Golf.
That's me.
And how long has William been studying or how long have you been mentoring William?
Unofficially, he's been studying failure his entire life, as have I. I myself come from a long line of people noted for their, you know, our only awareness of success was by its absence. It was a sort of a bubble that hung over everyone's head. Empty.
An empty bubble, kind of the thought.
Going back.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, with William, you have you've trained him not simply in what we would call contemporary American failure, but in some Eastern models and some ancient models.
Indian and Hindu failure models. I can say that because he's looking at me surprised right now that I have failed in coaching him in these directions. I thought that I was bringing these to him.
And thus enriched him yet further.
Further in his, enriched his education. Success.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know anything about this. So I've not accomplished what I was setting out to do the last 2 months.
And that's beautiful. And Dr. Tennis, would you say that William has excelled in one mode or aspect of failure more than the others? And you know, when the book is closed on William's failure, what kind of failure? What is his virtuosity above all the others?
Cultural, sociocultural, lack of business acumen.
Wonderful.
I'm very good at it. I like to, I can do a lot of things with my time because, I mean, for the most part, you know, it's everything that I'm doing that's failing isn't really affecting, like, my world. Not really. You know, I'm taken care of.
You're wealthy. It's inheritance. Which brings up another question.
I do a lot of sailing.
Would you say, William, that you come from a line of failures? Or is this...
Not if you listen to anybody, you know, from the family, because everybody's always just, you know, talking about how great everything used to be. You know,
until you got hold of the family reins, more or less.
I don't know. I don't really pay a lot of attention to it. I'm doing fine.
Do they see?
I just keep telling them I'm doing fine.
Oh, and do you find much resistance from the family? Have there been squabbles over the allocation of inherited monies and
some, you know, every now and then things get a little bit loud, and I find that if they do, if I move somewhere away from the loudness, that the problem for me goes away.
They sometimes ask him why he is retaining my services, and I've never really given a really good explanation, and that's only made them angrier.
The guy really, you know, you can see his strategy. And
incompetence.
So it's absolutely brilliant.
It's a day-to-day incompetence.
It's a transparent failure. It's a transparent failure. It's a failure the structures of which simply cannot stand. William, I do have a question for you as we run low on time here. Dr. James T. Golf has been known to me as a scholar of failure and of ruin. I believe is your other main area as distinguished from failure. Ruin.
Well, his book the book that's going to be coming out is Failure on the Way to Ruin.
Yeah.
Which I've been promising for years.
Certainly.
And
keep delaying.
And its absence is a beautiful failure of trust and...
Except that today he bought a copy with him. He said you were going to...
I've got an empty composition book here.
Oh.
We're just a couple of boys and a couple of girls.